18 minutes before 3 o'clock on the Afternoon Magazine. More and more of our personal business is reliant on the flow of information, thanks in part to the rise of the internet, and that's the most important vehicle for that flow now. We're also being judged more and more on our credit records, which lie in the electronic ether. That gives rise to a constantly changing security picture. And even as new ways are being developed to conduct business electronically and do it securely, there are people out there thinking of ways to circumvent the security and get to your information, whether it's for benign or sinister purposes. You can do some things to help keep that from happening. Among the many groups that are issuing warnings and studying the issue of identity theft is Consumers Union, not-for-profit agency that prints Consumer Reports magazine. The magazine's associate editor is Mary McQueen. She joins us this afternoon to talk about the subject. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
What transactions are the most likely places where an identity could be stolen? Where are we most at risk?
We're most at risk right now. Well, actually, there are a variety of ways. Many people have their identities stolen in routine and long-established ways, like having their information stolen from discarded materials, discarded financial statements and bills. Sometimes people, you know, will have their purse stolen or their wallet taken and the information extracted from the documents or credit cards, et cetera, that they have in there. But a new way and increasingly frightening and pervasive way that people's identities are being compromised is by hacking into or stealing information from databases that are maintained by big government and corporate entities.
What's being done to help secure that information? Obviously, it's in everybody's best interest to keep that stuff secure, but what is happening?
Well, our investigation found that not enough is being done to protect that information. These companies will collect it, but they don't protect it. Relatively few companies, large or small, are using encryption technology to make that information unintelligible to a hacker or other person who has gained access to it without legitimate right to have it. Even in terms of paper files, many businesses and even governments don't take the steps necessary to protect that information, particularly the Social Security number, which is often a key to being able to perpetrate ID theft or ID fraud. They don't do what they have to do to keep that material out of the hands of people who don't need to have it.
What is so insecure about the Social Security number?
Well, the Social Security number, in the first place, was never meant to be used as a universal identifier. A national ID is a very controversial concept in the United States, and there are a lot of people who have resisted or would resist the idea of such a thing. In the absence of any kind of a national ID, the Social Security number has become a de facto universal ID number that has been used by government and business to make sure that one John Smith is different from another John Smith. Aside from that, also, the driver's license is another credential. Really, it's a credential for driving. It was never meant to be to fulfill the function of a universal ID, but it really more or less is beginning to fill that function, especially in the post 9/11 world. Neither of these pieces of information has been guarded the way you would expect a unique identifier to be guarded.
What's being done to resolve that? What can be done? Apparently, I mean, is there a chance of living in a completely secure society from now on?
Well, there's never going to be a completely secure society, but in some states, notably California, and some others, they've taken more steps than other areas of the country to safeguard the Social Security number, to make certain that it is not displayed on, say, university IDs or as on a identity, work badge. requiring businesses to take steps to safeguard the information that is in their databases and making them legally responsible for breaches, requiring them to notify customers if their information has been compromised, which, you know, studies have shown in the past they haven't. The businesses haven't reported the breach to the customers, the consumers, nor have they reported it to law enforcement in many instances.
Obviously, if you know that information has been taken from you physically, or you know, if you know that you've been, your security has been breached, you can take evasive action. How do you know otherwise when something may have happened out, you know, separate from what we know, or through electronic means? How do we know that our identity has been stolen?
Unfortunately, many times we don't know until something is seriously amiss. One way that a lot of consumers have said they found out they were victims was when they received dunning notices or calls from the collection agencies about accounts that they never opened. That's a very bad way to find out. The other way is when they see unauthorized charges on a credit card or on their phone bill or cellular bill. And in some instances, people have been contacted proactively by their credit card companies or other financial institutions because they have received transactions or inquiries that are out of line with your usual consumption pattern. You know, in those kinds of credit card companies, especially, that have invested in software that, you know, detects that sort of thing.
What's the process then for undoing that damage? I've heard some instances where people have been stuck in this, and it is not a difficult or painless process.
It's a very difficult process. It's very painful in many instances. It can take many hours of work on correspondence, time on the phone, unraveling it, even though typically, because of fair credit laws and fair billing laws, the average consumer isn't out of pocket. That is, if they know their rights, they're not out of pocket for a huge amount of cash. Typically, we've found that victims lose $800 and spend maybe 2 years clearing their name. The first step is always, and because it's so difficult sometimes to find out that you've been a victim, although lately victims apparently have been finding out sooner than in the past, one of the things to do is to check your credit report regularly. It's not a typical habit in the United States to, you know, regularly run your own credit, but it's something that we advise consumers to do at least once a year with all three of the major credit reporting bureaus to make sure that there hasn't been someone masquerading as you and charging up, you know, phantom accounts and bills. The next thing you would want to do is to contact your credit bureau if anything does seem to be amiss. And after that, you have to contact the credit issuers. This is not a straightforward matter because you're going to have to prove that you are who you say you are and that those charges aren't yours. And that's what takes the time.
One thing that struck me when reading the Consumer Reports article that your magazine had put together was the fact that some ATMs out there are not necessarily ATMs or are being used for a different purpose other than besides just doling out money.
Right. You know, that's why we advise being very careful around strange and privately owned ATMs, such as the ones you might see at a grocery store or a gas station. Some of these ATMs are being used by organized crime as a appliance to collect their magnetic strip that contains the information on your account. These machines can be used to take that information right off the strip and store it. And that information can then be used to create counterfeit cards, or even to, you know, directly access your accounts.
How prevalent is that? Is there a lot of that going around, or is it fairly rare?
It's a growing crime. Like as with many crimes, where you are in the country, I mean, there seem to be like vogues in crime, and some areas are particularly prone to one type of crime, or, you know, sometimes they sweep the country, you know, along with whatever the group is that's perpetuating the crime. But or perpetrating the crime, but it is something that's growing. I can't really quantify it, but it's something that you're hearing of more and more, and not just the ATM machine that is rigged, but also skimming crimes that use a handheld card reader, which has been hidden by the a clerk in a store or a waiter or a bartender or someone like that to take the information also off the card, store it, and use it later to create a counterfeit card.
Now, we're all used to, you know, most of us who have been online and have done business transactions online are aware of secure servers and that sort of thing. But we all give information on us to certain people that we believe we trust. How do we ensure that that information is not going to be misused, and if things are not that things are not taken from us electronically that we don't know about?
Well, Consumer Reports advises everyone to check, not to give out information to businesses or individuals that you don't know. And that's not just on the computer, but also on the phone. If you get a call from telemarketers and they say, you know, we have this great deal for you. All we need is your name and social security number and date of birth and your mother's maiden name. Just don't give it to them, because there is no way for you to know that the person at the other end of the line is who he or she says that, you know, he is. So that's really the first thing. Likewise, when you're on the computer, recognize that you don't know when you receive unsolicited email that that email even comes from the organization or the firm that, you know, it is represented itself as. Like, for instance, there have been a number of crimes lately committed using email spoofs from AOL that, you know, purported to be from AOL or PayPal or some other legitimate enterprise, but they were not. They were actually fraudulent, counterfeit, more or less, messages from people who were just what they call phishing for information. And then that information was used to steal the identities of the people who responded. So the first law is don't do business with people unless you initiated the transaction. If somebody sends you an intriguing offer or you see a website that seems to offer a service or a product that you want, first take some steps to authenticate the email or the website that you're dealing with. One of the things, if they make a representation about their security check that it says like HTTPS for a secure website, or that there's some other indication that you are working on a secure site, sometimes you see a little key icon or a lock. You know, that's what you should be looking for.
You touched on some of the legislation that, for example, California has passed on security. How much legislation can be useful, and how much, how far can legislation go, and how much can it, in some cases, is it just window dressing for saying that we're doing something to fight identity fraud? But how effective can it be?
I think that laws, especially a tightening of the federal laws on this subject, especially given the fact that they just in Congress passed a Fair Credit Reporting Act. It's going to go on to the Senate that does not incorporate some of the stronger protections that exist in some states like California. We would like to see national legislation that really incorporates certain protections for the consumer. Like, for instance, we would like to see fraud victims get a free credit report every month for a year after reporting, after notifying credit reporting agencies that, you know, you've been a victim. We would like to see states require some sort of proof or at least 4 points of ID before releasing really important sensitive documents like your birth record. And consumers should be notified of their security breaches. I mean, how can you defend yourself if you don't even know that you've been compromised? It's just not fair to the consumer to allow people's information to be stolen and then not even to let them know so that they can take the steps that they need to protect themselves.
All right. Thanks.
And also, I believe, by the way, another really important thing is that, you know, if people are going to be using these Social Security numbers as they have been using them, First of all, they should be restricted. They shouldn't be used as widely as they are. Mm-hmm. And documents that are used for identification, like the driver's license and like the Social Security number, they have to be much more, government itself has to be much more careful about how they issue these documents. New Jersey, as a state, for example, just recently made it much more difficult to get a driver's license. You have to produce at least 4 pieces of other ID proving that you are who you say you are before you can get a driver's license. And part of that is a reaction to what happened after 9/11. You know, many of the hijackers were carrying phony documents, including driver's licenses, from the states.
Well, thanks for your time this afternoon. You gave us some things to think about when we want to protect our identities. Thank you very much, Mary.
Oh, you're welcome.
Mary McQueen is the associate editor at Consumer Reports.